With around 50% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people having a major chronic disease, the risks of COVID-19 in our community has the potential to be devastating and long-reaching. As a COVID-19 pandemic evolves, we need to ensure that the most vulnerable people in our communities feel safe and secure and their whole health needs are met. These risks are compounded by issues like overcrowding, health services already at capacity, access to testing, and quick turning around of results. I interviewed people on the ground from many different communities to understand the impact of COVID-19. The message for this podcast is clear. While the borders are shutting for the health of our community, we need to be considering how we get clear and concise messaging out, preparing for evacuation, and protecting our most valuable assets, our elders, the keepers of wisdom and knowledge. I am Dr. Danielle Arabina. Welcome to this special COVID-19 edition podcast for Indigenous Health Med Talk.
Indigenous Health Med Talks with Dr. Danielle Arabina, yarning with innovators, trailblazers and community leaders in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and medicine. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this podcast may contain the voices of persons now deceased. We would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians, Yuggera and Turrbal people, from where Dr. Danielle is broadcasting, and extend our acknowledgement to the elders past and present of all our listeners.
Welcome, Jeff Sperling, back to the show again, our special edition. Those who don't know Jeff, he is a GP at the Inala Indigenous Medical Service out at Inala with Noel Heyman. Jeff, what exactly is the coronavirus and tell me, how is it different to the flu?
Gosh, well, the coronavirus is one of those respiratory viruses that actually there are four of them already that circulate in humans as common colds and sometimes get into nursing homes and create havoc. But nothing quite like this one, I think, because it's sort of jumped straight out of the animal kingdom. It might have come from bats, perhaps, or pangolins. I don't actually know what a pangolin is. When something's been circulating amongst humans for a while, there's this general thinking that it's not really in the virus' interest to kill us. So if it's been around for a while, it's probably not as dangerous. Whereas if it's jumped straight out of animals, tends to be a lot more dangerous, which is why this particular corona is causing so much concern. I guess following the same sort of reasoning, influenza is quite a dangerous, or flu is quite a dangerous pathogen as well, and it circulates as seasonal influenza. We've seen that for quite a while, so a lot of people have at least some immunity to that. It's still a dangerous disease. Like I think in the US this year, it's something like 22,000 deaths in the season.
Yeah, right.
And 370,000 hospitalizations. So, and 36 million people got the flu. So it's still pretty serious. Flu tends to come on a lot quicker. So once you catch flu, you tend to show symptoms within a day to 4 days. Whereas corona takes about sort of 5 days to show symptoms on average. The thing with flu is, you know, it puts about 1% of people in hospital in a normal season, whereas this corona seems to be putting on US figures about 12% and in some figures sort of 18 to 20%. And it's obviously quite age related as well. So seasonal influenza has a death rate of about 0.1% of people who get it, whereas corona is at least 1%. So you're talking a 10 times worse, it seems to be very age dependent. So one of the really great pieces of news is that we're not looking at small children having to go to hospital and die and things like that. No one under 9 has died from this illness, which is incredible. But of course, you know, we certainly need to be very conscious of the difficult situation facing older people and you know, our parents and grandparents and elders in communities and people with immune issues and things like that, because that rate of hospitalisation and more serious outcomes really climbs as you get older, which is one of the really difficult things with this.
And that's the big thing, that this social distancing and what we're looking at, putting people into isolation, we're really trying to have this idea around flattening the curve. Flattening the curve is basically a strategy that's going to help the hospitals to be able to cope with the influx. But Jeff, are you able to talk to us about the idea of there's going to be a second peak? And what does that mean for the community?
Yeah, so the problem with this coronavirus is that, you know, it's new, so none of us have got any immunity. And it's really one of the things that has come out about this virus that's really concerning is it's just its ability to transmit. So on average, if someone has corona, they're likely to give it to 2 or 3 other people in normal circumstances. And that's really quite significant. You know, the influenza is much less than that. So it's, you know, 1.2 people you might give it to or something like that. I mean, to put it in a bit of context, something like measles is unbelievably contagious. You know, you'll give it to 15 people. Chickenpox, you'll give it to 8 people. Smallpox is sort of like the worst combination of fatality and spreading. Like you give smallpox to 5 people and about 20 or 30% of people would die. So that was kind of horrific. Whereas this coronavirus, the problem with this one is some of the previous coronaviruses that have been really bad, like SARS and MERS, they were really terrible in terms of killing people. Like SARS had a 10% mortality and MERS has a 30% mortality. But they just weren't as contagious. So the problem with this virus is it's super contagious and we don't have any way of dealing with it other than stopping people from interacting with each other. Predictions are that it'll go through, you know, I've heard predictions from 20 to 50% of various populations. And so the thing is, there's this flattening the curve, which is super important. Otherwise, we end up with the apocalypse, which is going on in some European countries and starting to happen in the US and has certainly been happening in Iran, where if you've got a 12 to 20% hospitalization rate, there just aren't that many. ICUs are already fairly full. Like you just can't cope with that sort of level of people coming in. It just becomes totally overwhelmed. So we really need to avoid that. But the problem with that, of course, is that if you're isolating everyone to reduce the number of cases, then it's sort of trickling through the population, which is great. But then, as you say, once people come out of isolation, it'll start picking up again.
It'll pick up again and then we'll get that sort of second peak that they're talking about. I think the thing, Jeff, that a lot of people don't, or maybe are not thinking about, they'll think, I'm only going to get this mildly, like it's not really going to impact on me because I'm young and healthy. The thing is, ICU beds, as you were rightly saying, are already going to be very full and busy. But if you've got non-COVID-19 things that take you to hospital, like a heart attack or you've been in a motor vehicle accident or something like that, how are you going to be looked after? So that's why it's so important that we as a community try to, the worst thing we have to do is wash our hands and sit on the couch for a bit. You know, that might be very helpful to help our community.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there are so many things to unpack there. I mean, for the social isolation thing, the safest place for everybody is in their house. Really, if you can be at home, you need to be at home. Because the more socially isolated you are, the more chance there is of interrupting this transmission and stopping that sort of catastrophic outcome. As far as the hospitals being overloaded, you're absolutely right. So, I mean, I've basically said to the family, we're not doing anything dangerous. I mean, obviously, for our well-being, we're going to exercise, but we're not going to mountain bike, for example, or, you know, do high-risk things that could end up fracturing things and ending up in hospital, which the hospital just will not be able to afford it.
Yeah.
I think the message for a lot of people would be this is a really good time to get fit. Lose a couple of kilos, stop eating takeaway, maybe stop smoking. I know it's hard when everyone's stressed out, but you want to be prepared for this impending, in Australia anyway, it's already hit some countries obviously, but in Australia you want to be preparing now to get that little bit fitter, lose a couple of kilos.
Well, it's a bit bloody hard when I'm working from home, Jeff. Hey, I've got the fridge next by, cup of tea time.
Well, did you see that guy in China who did an ultra marathon in his living room?
No, I did not.
50Ks, yeah.
Ow, on the treadmill.
No, he ran around his table. He had a table in the middle of the room and went out on the balcony and came back and did, I don't know how many laps, but it was obviously quite a few.
Well, let's see if we can get the Indigenous community behind table running, see how that could be a public health initiative right there, Jeff. You and I have started that. I will not be doing it, just FYI.
It's going to be a thing. You'll definitely get
it. I will not be. I don't run, so sorry. Okay, so with Inala, what are your sort of, so Inala is quite unique in the fact that, quote unquote, it's a urban sort of clinic, but I know that you have a lot of mob who travel in from all over to come to your wonderful centre. So what are your sort of concerns around, you know, the immediate and the long-term effects in the community? And then what are your ongoing concerns?
Well, I guess my immediate concern is the message gets out there that people, the safest place for people is to be at home. In a community that's usually quite mobile, that could involve quite a lot of changes. I guess I'm concerned that home's not always a safe place for some people. Some people don't have a home. So there's an awful lot of concern I've got around that. Having people safely housed away from domestic violence or family violence and other sort of safety issues like that concerns me, I guess.
And so what has Inala got in place? Like, what are we doing there?
Well, I guess the main thing for Inala is to try and keep patients and clinic staff safe. we really don't want to close down and lose that primary healthcare service. So the minute someone gets a coronavirus confirmation within our staff, we're going to be in trouble. You know, very other clinics have had to close down for 2 weeks. So that'd be a disaster for the community. So we're really trying to avoid that. So we've got a nurse out the front. So it's all our measures are, we've got meetings, you know, it's a real team effort. We're meeting 10 minutes before we start every morning in clinic. And then we've got a task force that meets at lunch for the broader issues.
Yes.
But in a nutshell, we've got a nurse out the front now who's screening everybody.
Mm-hmm. For fevers when they come in asking the questions.
Yeah, that's right. And you've got to remember that there's some gastrointestinal symptoms with this as well. So not to forget those. So, you know.
Is this why the toilet paper is running off the shelves, Jeff?
No, I think the toilet paper is a really, I mean, everyone's losing their brain. I mean, I think it's pretty normal to be anxious, and it's just a strange manifestation of that, I guess. You know, it's a bit Freudian, isn't it? We're all a bit anal at the end of the day, but.
Nice one, Jeff. I like what you did there, mate.
The toilet paper one I certainly didn't predict, but we'll see coming. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there is no supply issue that I can see. I haven't seen no indication of that. I don't think we need to be panic buying anything.
Mm.
So that is what it is, I guess. But I think it's a real manifestation of people's general insecurity. I think the authorities have something to answer for there in the sense that the messages have not been clear. It would have been great to have sort of pandemic preparedness better funded and more sort of continuously funded, and we just would have been more ready. I think there has been some funding of that, and the people in those positions, I'm sure, are doing an excellent job. But just the messaging, I think at all government levels perhaps could have been a bit better. But
We were looking at online, there was someone told me that their wife was actually looking at just doing a bit of Googling around what do we need to do to stock up for stuff in case of emergency. And they actually found the shopping list that was more prevalent for fires and floods where supply is cut. And things like the rice, the water, the toilet paper, all of those things that are short now. So we're like, is that because that's not really relevant to this particular pandemic? You know, it would have been good to sort of, as you said, get that message out differently, because they're going onto government websites and finding that this is what you need, an emergency kit. This is what you need to do to prepare yourself and your family. So people driven by fear are looking for these things and then going, oh no, I need to go out and buy all these things.
Yeah. And of course, lots of people who come to our service can't afford to do that sort of hoarding. And, you know, and it's terrible when you turn up to a supermarket and you've only got enough money to buy food for the next few days or whatever, or that day. And there's what you want isn't there. It's pretty terrible. But at least we're ready for a fire then, if one comes on top of the pandemic.
Well, I hope not, mate, because we started the year off not too well here in Australia. So
that's right. Yeah, no, it's been pretty tough.
It has been. Well, thank you so much, Jeff, for coming and joining us today and giving us some insight around what is the coronavirus. And, you know, all those statistics are quite sobering, particularly I think because people think, oh, it's just like the flu, it's not going to impact on me. Whereas we can see that the impacts are going to be both immediate and long term and potentially quite dramatic for some families. I think about my poor old mum who had cancer and passed last year, but, you know, her going through chemo, this would have been very scary on top of it. So just thinking about all of the people out there in the community who have chronic diseases and, you know, dealing with immune compromised states.
Yeah, we've got to do our best to look after them, that's for sure. I've told my parents to, we might not see them for a while. I've just got to write it out at home, and same with a lot of people in community.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks for coming, Jeff. Love your work.
Thanks, Daniel.
Kenton Winsley from the Northern Territory. Kenton is the Senior Advisor for the Department of Health for the Northern Territory Government. He's a paramedic. He's an Aboriginal health practitioner. We're so grateful for you coming and joining us today on this very special edition. Tell me, Kenton, what are your biggest concerns for COVID-19 in your community?
My small community in the Territory is called Bellew, and we have a small population, but the population is a vulnerable population like many other Aboriginal communities across Australia. My concerns have been around the lack of preparations in the communities, I guess support from federal and local governments around having conversations with the communities to start preparing them for this pandemic and what we can be doing collectively to mitigate the risk and potentially save thousands of lives.
Absolutely, because I see that over the weekend there was a call from Pat Turner, CEO of Nacho, who was demanding the government, the federal government, declare a special isolation zone that's patrolled by police and potentially the army to prevent this devastating effect of COVID-19 getting into remote Indigenous communities. And so what we're seeing, you know, around the world, we're seeing borders being shut. And essentially that's what we need to do to protect our vulnerable communities. But I suspect with that, there comes a lot of challenges around, you know, a potentially transient population, people who are moving around, you know, into potentially, you know, Darwin and then heading back out to communities. How do you navigate all of that?
Closing borders, closing off communities, I think is a great initiative. And again, it's a conversation we should have had a couple of months ago, when the World Health Organization, I think around the 25th of January, said that we are faced with a public health emergency. That's when we should have been discussing business contingency plans. How are we going to work with these vulnerable communities? How are we going to mitigate the risk around those transmissions? And some of the research that I've read over the last week around closing borders is one element of reducing the risk of COVID-19 coming into a particular area and causing the infection, but it shouldn't be the be-all and end-all of what we're trying to achieve. We should be having the conversation around, well, if we can tighten our borders, if we can tighten people coming in and out of a community, but then also we need to have the serious conversations around the social distancing. What does that look like amongst Aboriginal people, amongst our everyday life, meeting our cultural obligations? We know that we have both territory and federal government saying, as much as we can, business as usual for Aboriginal people, living our cultural lives and having cultural obligations, that's business as usual. So how do we make sure that we can mitigate the risk of that transmission, but also meet what our obligations are? So even though that we're having these conversations and we know that we've got our Chief Minister looking at what the legal options are in terms of closing borders, reducing people's movements, but we should also be saying, how are we going to address social distancing, social isolation, when we already know that Aboriginal people are living to up to 20 to 30 people in one household? We already know that the infrastructure is poor. We know that the infrastructure is run down. We know that some houses don't have a bathroom operating. We know in places in Central Australia, one of the reasons why Australia as a first world country still has a disease like trachoma is because of poor infrastructure around people's ability to maintain and practice good hygiene.
Yes.
So how are we going to truly mitigate the risk of COVID-19?
And you know, even we say wash your hands, but people don't actually comprehend that it's almost like a surgical scrub that we have to do. You know, you have to be washing enough to break down the viral capsule to sort of, you know, help wash it off. So I think you've raised a lot of really important points there. And I love what you were talking about, the social and cultural obligations we have. I mean, things around, you know, what I'm really concerned about is prolonging sorry business that we're not able to meet for funerals, or even the idea, like I know a family who are unable to put to rest their family member. And so, but then it also puts them at risk because they've got to think about, now they've got to find more money to sort of keep, the, you know, have the body being kept for them in a home, or not in a personal home, but, you know, by a undertaker. But it's horrific. Like those sorts of things is prolonging our grief and causing more disconnection in our society.
Yeah, and you're right. It's trying to help communities understand COVID-19, try and understand the significant risk it poses to our elderly.
Yes.
The significant risk it poses to our way of life. And we know that the government is talking about this being a 6, 12, 18-month interruption to our daily lives. Mm. I'm worried that we have missed the boat on some of these opportunities to have the conversations with the communities, to help them to make informed decisions about what they can do to help reduce the spread. Yes. But also meet those obligations.
Kenton, we were having a chat before and you rightly said, you know, on a good day, particular health services who are working remotely are very stretched. I've been reading reports that for swabs results to come back, for instance, in urban areas, it's a couple of days. Where you might be, it might be like a week or two. And having to keep someone in that isolation or in quarantine until they get the swab results is going to be quite challenging. And also PPE across the board, that is low. So, you know, have you guys been able to stockpile PPEs for your staff?
Look, when I speak for our remote clinics, my experience would only go as far as saying our remote clinics that are funded by the Northern Territory Government, managed by Northern Territory Government. Yes. We do have a number of clinics that are run by Aboriginal medical organisations, medical services. I would be quite confident to think that they would be following what the Territory Government's saying, what the Australian Government's saying in terms of being prepared. I know that our remote clinics, from a stockpile point of view, will be well prepared. I know that we are well placed in the Territory because we actually have the National Trauma Critical Care and Trauma Response Centre located at our hospital.
Fantastic.
So I know that in terms of being able to respond from a PPE point of view, our staff will be okay.
Yes.
When we talked about services being stretched on a good day, We know, I'm not going to teach you how to suck eggs. You know the rate of Aboriginal people dying, the chronic diseases we all face with. How can we make sure that services can receive the additional support that they're going to need? How do we make decisions about those that are being sent into either a regional hospital or to the major hospital, Royal Darwin Hospital, for definitive care if they're becoming unwell from the virus? As much as our health centres itself might be well equipped and well prepared to manage this, I go back to the concerns that I have around the community engagement.
Yes.
Educating the community. I say it again, I'm really worried that we've missed the boat in some of those opportunities to have these discussions. What decisions or what conversations are we having locally and more broader around the isolation of one person that we might suspect is having COVID-19? Where does that person go in one of our remote communities? You know, we're flat strapped for housing on a good day. Where does that person go? How do they access services?
I think I was reading somewhere that there was potentially talk if the army was getting involved to sort of set up a mobile quarantine, I don't know, hospital or tent or something like that. But it is, you know, all those points you're saying is quite pertinent and makes my poor little brain is having a bit of a meltdown, because I was just thinking about, you know, retrievals. If you had to bring somebody in from the community who either had COVID or, I mean, you'd probably get them to stay there, but, or people who are on renal dialysis, for instance, like how are we sort of continuing that care if we're shutting borders? I know that essential people can sort of come and go, but it just seems really difficult.
Yeah, and when we talk about shutting borders, in places like Central Australia, and I must disclose that I'm not from Central Australia, so I've never pretend to speak on their behalf.
Absolutely.
But with places like Central Australia, they're so well close to the borders, they're so well connected to WA, South Australia, Queensland. And from an Aboriginal point of view, we don't see the borders that our governments draw on a map. So will governments take that into consideration, and how does that look? And this is what I mean by I'm worried that we've missed this opportunity.
Mm.
We're trying to have these conversations now when we wake up every day seeing the number of cases
increasing
in Australia. And I go back to one of the research articles I read last night. It was saying, yes, obviously close the borders to try and stop what's coming in.
Mm.
But once it's already there, our big focus now should be around stop community transmission, stop person-to-person transmission.
Absolutely.
And are we really doing everything that we can to achieve that?
Mm. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that, and this is something I'll be talking about in this podcast a lot, is that health is for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is not just your physical health. It's your emotional health. It's your spiritual health. It's your mental health. But one of the things I think that has a big impact is the financial impact of this on people. Some families mightn't have money to go hoarding toilet paper like everybody else. So there's a lot of stress and anxiety that we're seeing ripping across Australia. So I'm imagining it's all in all communities. I was just reading an article about, you know, up in the Torres Strait, the fishers are being really affected economically because rock lobster, the Chinese people aren't buying the rock lobsters off the Torres Strait Islanders. And so the value of those have fallen dramatically. So for people who are out fishing to support their family, that's no longer an option. So I've got great concerns in the community around things that we used to do, like ecotourism. That would be big for Darwin. What's the impact of that?
And you're right. The Territory recently had the NTFL Grand Final. What runs alongside that is the Tiwi Island Grand Final. Every year on Grand Final, we see charters of planes heading over. People come from all over the country to come to Darwin and fly over to Tiwi Islands to watch their grand final.
Mm.
But at the same time, they're able to open up their art centre. They're able to sell their local art, engage with the wider Australian population, and people come there and spend their money there for the day. So it's a massive economic boost for that community on that day. Well, this year, Tiwi Islands had to shut its own borders and say only local people can come to the grand final. So that would have been a massive
hit
to their economy. We know, like in the coming months, places like Barunga will be preparing for their sports and cultural festival, which is normally held around the Queen's birthday weekend.
Mm.
We've got the Mattapan Arts Festival that's held in Mayu down in Daly River around that same period. So as much as these bigger places get the publicity around closing activities and people losing jobs or us or all those places losing much-needed money in those areas, our disadvantaged, our most vulnerable parts of Australia are making those same decisions.
Yes.
And being hit with the same economic disaster. And we should keep that in mind. It's not just these bigger festivals that happen in urban metropolitan areas. Mm. It's smaller, remote that really rely on that.
Mm. Kenton, thank you so much for your time. I've really appreciated all of the stuff that you're able to talk to us about. Oh, just briefly before I go, I don't think we touched on the Larrakia Return to Country initiative. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
So I, like many, came across the flyer. It's a Northern Territory Government initiative working with the local Larrakia organisation here to help send Aboriginal people that might be living in Darwin in at-risk areas, mm-hmm. so those who are living on the streets, in what we would define as living in the long grass, to send them back home. Again, I wonder if those initiatives are a little too late. We have COVID-19 in Australia. Yes, I understand we only have one case in Darwin, but their initiatives we should have addressed a month ago so we could truly prepare for what's about to come.
On that note, Kenton, thank you again for coming. I feel you're right. I think this scrambling that we're doing now is almost like that catch up. And with any sort of, I know, disaster management planning, that you always have some sort of things that'll, excuse my language, but fuck up in a way so that you can learn from it. And it's just unfortunate that this is the instance where we are fucking up, potentially. Not saying that we are government, but, but we can learn from this and really try to help the company and organisations. Thank you very much for your time, and we'll talk again soon. So now I'd like to welcome Dr. Bianca Beetson, who works at Griffith University in charge of the Indigenous Research Unit. Welcome, Bianca.
Hi, Danielle.
So, Bianca, you are a prominent artist in the community. I hope I don't shame job you by saying that, but I've been really thinking a lot around COVID-19 and the impacts on our communities from a holistic viewpoint. Particularly, I'm interested in the economic effects and how cuts or the potential closures of museums and places where we can display artwork, like what's the impact that you can see?
I mean, we were one of the first people to be affected in the arts. I mean, the very moment they said no gatherings over 500, it automatically saw the closure of major events, museums, festivals, etc. in the near future. And then day by day, you know, the government are saying, you know, less, you know, I think now it's down to no more than 20 inside a building. Some of our big institutions have remained open, but as you've seen, places like QPAC have closed. And I think it's only a matter of time before major institutions like the Gallery of Modern Art close. I mean, I think it was yesterday and the day before, every 5 minutes I was having an email from a gallery saying, we've closed the doors because of this. Some galleries are trying to do other kind of things around their openings by going, the artists are doing, you know, having an all-day opening where they will take VIPs in small groups of about 10 through the shows every hour. But, you know, that also has a big impact on the artist, exposes artists to health issues as well themselves. And yes, the artist should be, you know, given the option to not be there, especially for Indigenous artists. And then, of course, you know, major areas where, many artists rely on, you know, these businesses and these gigs that they get, and even sometimes it might even just be, you know, giving artist talks or lectures or whatever, all help bread and butter on the table.
Mm.
And so as these major institutions are closing and even the smaller institutions are closing, you know, our artists are actually the first on the line to lose their income. I mean, we've seen a diabolical impact of economically right across the country, right across the world. And it's not just our artists that are suffering, but, you know, we're often living week to week, paycheck to paycheck, gig by gig as it is.
Yes, yep.
You know, we don't, and a lot of our artists don't have super and they don't have savings and all these other sorts of things that they can fall back on.
Mm.
And then, of course, you know, when we're looking at Indigenous artists in remote communities, it is really, really vital as far as, you know, many of them are already vulnerable and, you know, connected, you know, already have dialysis issues, et cetera.
Yes.
And so a lot of the art centres are going to have to close down because of, again, numbers of people in groups and social isolation issues. So a lot of the art centre activities won't happen. Major events like Darwin Art Fair, Cairns Indigenous Art Fair at this stage, I assume will be cancelled. I know Cairns will be because of it being around July and they're already talking about NAIDOC week. I mean, NAIDOC's so important even as far as grassroots artists getting their work out and making sales. I'm hoping a lot of the arts, I mean, for a lot of the art centres, yes, they can sell their work online and they can, you know, change the way they distribute things, but there's issues around the production of the work.
Yes. Yep.
And, you know, the handling. And again, financially, if these big institutions are not buying work, not all these exhibitions are being cancelled for up to a 6-month period, you know, there's no money going back into these spaces. You know, these artists are not getting anything. The art centres aren't getting anything. I know Arts Queensland offered to support some of the bigger centres and some of the bigger galleries, and they're looking at another sort of financial sort of aid package for the arts. Stimulus, that's the word, yeah. For the arts and for the individuals. But, I mean, you know, it has a flow and effect. You know, picture framers are going to the wall who are already struggling. Today, you know, we know of some that are closing their doors. course, with the music industry, you've got bars closing, and that impacts these independent little sort of musicians and everything. So it is absolutely dire consequence, you know, after we've already received major funding impacts across the sector, to now then actually be in a situation where we're kind of going, there is no work, no one's going to be buying work. I mean, of course, art has a great therapeutic kind of benefit for people and communities, and it would be ideal if we could, during this time, sit down and make art, because that's our way to help get through it. And, you know, I know in my own role and position, and previously I'm trying to support the new person in my position at Queensland College of Art to be able to help bring teaching online, but talking about practical teaching online. So how do we teach ceramics online? How do we teach possum skin cloak making online and our cultural stuff that needs to be done to our students that would normally be taught hands-on? And so, you know, webinars and those kinds of things are really important, but there's nothing the same as one-on-one.
No.
And even things like having access to materials and equipment to do that, and particularly things that, if you're not an art material hoarder like me, you know, and you actually can't just walk into your little space and grab out some canvases, grab paint, grab whatever you need, can have a major impact. Most people are currently just scrambling to make sure there's food on the table, you know, if there are lockdowns and shutdowns, right, you know. And, of course, without mentioning issues around cultural ceremonies and being able to allow for artists to be able to actually practice their cultural ceremony, go out and collect their reeds and different materials that they might actually need from the natural environment as well. I mean, hopefully, and I know a lot of the remote communities have locked down already, but a lot of areas already affected by drought and climate change and fires as well. So a lot of our natural materials aren't available to be able to make things. So, you know, artists are having to, they want to continue with their basket weaving practices and processes. You know, they have to actually change the materials they're using. I judged an art prize in Broken Hill a few weeks back, and I was talking to one of the artists, and she said, oh, these are my bowls that I've made out of recycled newspaper. And she said, I've had to use it because the reeds aren't available that I would normally make them from. So, you know, we are having to be a little bit more resilient. And that's one thing I can say about us. But we're having to be a little bit changing what we're doing and how we're using things and materials. But if we're locked down, you know, it does change a hell of a lot of the way we practice. But it might be the way we get through this.
Yes.
I'm looking at ways that we could probably have online yarning places as well, so that particularly in that area of arts and creative research, how do we help people progress their PhDs and their master's research projects? You know, what impact does it have on artists that have got funded projects that are time-specific that might involve community consultation that can't physically be done by actually physically travelling to the Northern Territory or Cairns or, you know, somewhere, or even out to Dirranbandi to meet with their community? How do we, you know, how do we support and facilitate these processes, these artists that need to go back to their community and ask for permissions to do things that might be working on major shows that have these, you know, big funded projects? I mean, I'm currently in the process of assessing grants for a major funding body, and so many of our applications we're looking at are going to be majorly impacted by COVID-19. So, you know, we will go back to artists that we think the projects are worth supporting, but kind of looking at, is there a way that timelines and stuff can be negotiated? I'm on the board of a small Indigenous arts organisation, and again, we've now had to put off major, major funded projects. They've been had to be placed on hold indefinitely until this is over, you know, and we've got an album ready to be recorded, but and there's the kids been working on this project for 2 years, and it's also managing their disappointment in that space.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that's a lot of the thing too, that just drawing it back to the health field is that sort of idea of grief and loss, that you can't complete something that you've put your heart and soul into, or something that means so important, something that has a certain amount of heart that you've been working with to help your community or to help yourself. And certainly there's the idea of the link between the spirituality aspect and art, and how is that going to be impacted by that? Because that's such an important part. Spirituality is such an important thing for our mob. Will that be sort of decimated? And I love, Bianca, that you said, you talked about the resilience of the artists. And I think as a people that, you know, we've gone through a lot of trauma, and we hold trauma, and it's not saying that I want us to keep holding trauma, but we've evolved with that trauma and we've responded to things that have caused us pain. And we've sort of come together as a community and become stronger where we can. So that's my hope, is that even though this is very devastating, that we can all sort of band together to help the Indigenous communities. And have you got any sort of hot tips for any GPs or doctors or people who will be listening to this podcast about how we can provide ongoing support for our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists and musicians?
I mean, one thing would be making sure that they have access to free health care. I mean, that's, you know, I know it, some of my students can't afford $75 to go to a doctor. And also understanding that 70% of our Indigenous artists are living in urban areas. And, you know, there's a lot of free health care and access to community health centres within regional and remote. But in the city centres and the urban centres, it's not often as easy to access. So, you know, that would be one of the big things. But also when the doctors and everything, when this is said and done, I think, you know, if they could be putting Aboriginal artists' works on the wall, we're going to have, you know, we're going to have a really tough slog and get out there and support the arts. And even if they can at this point, get online and buy some work. A lot of artists also have merchandise. Etsy's a great place. You've got places like Redbubble where a lot of artists are doing their, selling their designs. But you've also got a lot of the art centres that also have their works online. A lot of art have their own. A lot of artists have their own websites and stuff. But it's also sharing people's work online and kind of, you know, let's break this horrible thing that's going on social media at the moment. Everything's about COVID-19 and doom and gloom, and we're all going to die. Let's share some happiness and sprinkle some fairy dust across there and show this great art project opportunities to showcase. And, you know, this is part of my strategy of surviving the zombie apocalypse is, you know, how do we share great TED Talks and stuff that artists have done? How do we, you know, provide a lot of this online stuff that's been growing over the years, and these, you know, where artists are telling their stories, share them with people and get people to watch things and read things and educate themselves in that space a bit more and use this downtime to do that. That's providing the internet bandwidth stands up.
Yes, you know, that's right, because everyone will be home and searching stuff. But Bianca, I'd love you to be able to forward that to us, and we'll be able to put some of those links or whatever on our show notes so people can have a listen to that. But Bianca, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you dropping in. I know that you've had back-to-back meetings and there's crises everywhere. So thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom and your knowledge with us. And I wish you all the best in this zombie coming time. Hopefully there's no zombies coming. All right, love, take care, and I'll talk to you very soon.
Thank you.
So I'd like to welcome Dr. Carly Haywood to the show. Carly, tell us what's happening down in Radelaide or Adelaide way.
Yeah, I'm a GP. I work at the Aboriginal Family Clinic in Noarlunga, which is in the southern suburbs of Adelaide. Yeah, people are just trying to get as much information as they can on the COVID-19 coronavirus outbreak. We need to be quite vigilant in the Aboriginal community with this virus. They're estimating that this is going to be worse than the swine flu for our Aboriginal community. And with the swine flu, the rates of death were 6 times higher within the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander community than in the non-Indigenous community. So this is why we need to be quite vigilant. And on top of our messages that we get out to the community.
Everyone that I speak to and on social media, there's a lot of fear and anxiety running through the community. Is that sort of what you're experiencing in your communities you work in?
I think there's a group that are quite concerned and quite anxious, but then there's another group that feels that things are just being blown out of proportion. Mm. So we meet in the middle, and it's about consistent messaging for our community. Mm-hmm. It's about ensuring that talk about measures that they can do to protect themselves and protect their family, and keep it quite clear what we say to our community, so that there's a balance out there of being alert but not panicked.
Yes. You know, I've been talking a bit throughout this episode around holistic health and how important it is for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people for our health to be seen as a holistic entity, not just our physical symptoms we might have. So I was sitting down and I was thinking around coronavirus and its potential sort of impacts. And we just touched briefly on potential emotional stuff around stress, worry and fear, but also exacerbation of mental health illnesses, particularly around isolation and disconnection as we move into that phase of social isolation and, you know, even forced quarantine. What are your thoughts around that?
Look, we know that our body and mind are so connected. And if we ignore one and just focus on another, we're only ever going to look after half the person. So we really do need to be mindful that, again, we have consistent messaging out there. We check in on those of our community that we know have mental health problems. The government has allowed us to access Medicare numbers now so that we can call patients up who are in that vulnerable group, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with comorbidities who are over 50 fit that criteria. So I think we need to utilise all different types of communication pathways so that we can support our patients through this crisis.
And even things like overcrowding in houses, how do we can say on paper you have to do social distancing, but, you know, how do we do that in real life or real time when you've got, you might have your grandparents living with you or grandkids? You know, we know that children are potentially going to be more of a carrier than having the symptoms. What's the impact on the community?
So this is a very real concern amongst Aboriginal community controlled health services. It's very easy to say you need to self-isolate or you need to do social distancing, but within our communities, we often see the household having 17 people living in the community. It is also our cultural obligation to go and check in on our elders and make sure that they're well, they have enough food, so they'll have people coming in and out. So again, we've got to look at Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as a special case and get that consistent messaging out there. We also know that a lot of our Aboriginal community live in poorer housing, so they don't have the running water, they don't have hot water, those sorts of things as well. So we really need to be quite mindful. And I know that the Nacho CEO, Pat Turner, is very concerned and wanting to get on top of it straight away, even talking about getting the Australian Defence Force into some of these remote communities to get their health, get the doctors in there and the nurses in there. A lot of our communities have very small clinics that do not have a lot of equipment, and particularly within the Northern Territory, they're only testing in Darwin. And so it can take 5-6 days to get the results back. In the meantime, the virus would spread throughout the community. So we need to be looking at how we can protect communities. And I know in Alice Springs that the Aboriginal community organisations got together yesterday and have advised the NT minister to close the borders of the Northern Territory. And we can see that in other communities, at Palm Island,
Wyland. Cherbourg have just started as well,
Yeah. So those sorts of measures, really protecting our community from non-essential travellers entering, potentially bringing this virus, because once it's in there, it's going to be quite deadly for our community.
And absolutely right, Carly. And so other things I was thinking about, particularly around our spirituality and, you know, the ways that we might connect to the country, the way that we might be able to walk around or, you know, do things that are important spiritually to us to make us feel okay and well and centered in ourselves, opportunities might be taken away from us. We mightn't be able to do the ceremonies that we might be able to do if we, you know, even the way women are birthing now have changed. Like, you can only have one person as a support person in, you know, I know in the hospitals in Queensland. So what are your thoughts? I mean, I know your husband is a pastor, preacher, minister,
pastor.
Pastor Ben, you know, what's happening in that sort
of
spiritual sense?
One lot of pasta from the shops, so I've got mine at home.
Oh, nice one. Hey, I see what you did there. Come on, mate. Yeah, seriously. Spirituality is important.
Yes. So I think this has a huge impact on our community. Again, as you said, we've been advised that we need to limit the number of people gathering together. And so if we think of the inmars and the ceremonies that happen on country that may not be able to go ahead. We also need to think about funerals and people gathering for funerals. And it's a very significant part of our culture and cultural protocols that we attend funerals. And so these are another things that we need to think about. How can we use virtual mechanisms that we can link into with the community so continue to do the things that they need to do. I know within my church that we've limited handshaking, we do social distancing, we do usually have a greeting song, we're not doing that anymore. Mm. We can't partake in communion. So it's changing times. And again, it's about consistent messaging and making sure we get that message out there.
And I think, you know, talking about technology, as you will know very well, Carly, I find myself quite the expert on technology. That is not true.
That's not true.
But, you know, I just think about people, like we're talking about taking things online and you and I are sitting here having this conversation via Zoom. But for some people who are in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, they mightn't actually feel competent or comfortable using this sort of technology for a lot of different reasons.
Or even access to.
Access. Like not everyone's going to have Wi-Fi and, you know, absolutely Zoom on their not. iPhones.
A lot of the problem, even within an urban setting, is having credit on your phone.
Mm.
And a lot of our patients just don't have credit to be contacting their health service. And then so they walk in. And so we need to look at ways in which we can protect clinic.
So, Carly, you know, we've talked a lot around economic impacts for communities up in the Torres Strait. They weren't able to do their rock lobster fishing and exporting to China. So that was an opportunity lost. We've heard about small little festivals that sort of help supply the community. All of those things are being stopped now. As we're experiencing GP land, a lot of things are being cancelled. What do you see the potential economic risks for your community?
I think this is a very real concern. We know that a lot of our Aboriginal workers are working in low income paying jobs and in casual jobs. And so they may potentially not have an income if they've lost their casual job, if their workplace closed down. And so that has a big flow on effect into their families, then into the community. We're seeing that people are going out there and buying up on groceries and those sorts of things, but a lot of our community live from week to week, and so they're not able to go out and get the large amounts of food that people are getting. So people just need to be mindful that you don't need to hoard, that there are people out there that only get paid fortnightly and they need to be able to access food. But this is a very, very real concern amongst the Aboriginal community around income and loss of income and the flow-on effects that we'll have in the smaller communities. I think we need to look at delivery of food into communities and the potential impact of increasing cost of food in community as well as access. So there are lots of different ways that loss of income can impact on the health, not just of the individual, but of the whole community.
Yeah, and quite often, you know, for people who don't know that, quite often, you know, one wage might support three or four different families.
Absolutely.
So when we lose those jobs, the impact on the community is great. And then all of that then adds to the compounding stress. We know that stress and increasing cortisol levels have a direct impact on our health and well-being. The other thing, Carly, I'm really worried about in these vulnerable communities is our elders, and elders being at risk, really worried about the potential for, again, this whole loss of a knowledge base that we've experienced before through, you know, stolen generation stuff and policies of removal. But just what are your thoughts around that?
So people have been thinking about this and are very concerned about this as well. And this was the premise for why the APY lands, Arnungal, Pitjantjatjara, Yunkantjatjara lands, have closed their borders, so to speak. So they want to protect the elders. They want to protect the knowledge that the elders have. And so they've made this very wise decision, but difficult decision. We then got to think about in South Australia, we have the elders village, so our Aboriginal nursing home, and what things are being put in place. Are they limiting contact? Are they isolating patients? So there's a flow-on effect that we really need to be mindful of. And then our elders who are vulnerable in the community, who have comorbidities, who have heart disease, who have diabetes, hypertension, we need to make sure that we are keeping an eye on them, monitoring them, ensuring that they get help when they need it. So our elders are a vital part of who we are as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and we need to make sure that we protect them as best we can, not expose them unnecessarily to this virus.
I really feel all the things that you're saying there, Carly, particularly, you know, around the loss of my own mother last year. But it just makes you think, like, all the things you should have been doing or you could have done. And I think that this, where we're moving more into that social distancing and potentially being isolated with people, is actually just to sit down and yarn with people and hear their stories, or find some way to record the stories of your grandparents. And because I think too often we as an Indigenous community have a lot of regrets that we didn't sit down and spend the time. And this might be a really lovely exercise to do during this period.
Well, I think it's also looking at other ways in which we have an oral history. And so we're very used to sitting down and having a yarn, but we have technology now that we can record our elders, we can record their voice, we can record themselves talking. And so we need to think about utilising that technology to be able to capture our history so that it's passed on to our children and our children's children. But we, you know, being mindful of what we have been told by the health department of not putting our elders at risk by not visiting them unnecessarily, but we need to balance that out by ensuring that we are maintaining our culture into the future.
I saw a lovely snapshot on social media actually, and it was a gentleman who was in an aged care home. I think he was in America, but his son was outside, sitting out. So did you see that too? He was outside in the glass and he was sitting on a chair outside, and they were both just separated by this glass but having a big yarn on the phone.
Yeah.
And I think using things like that and working ways around it is that we can help protect our elders, help make them still feel connected, loved, safe, held, secure, which are all the things that are so important to us.
And I think you've touched on something. It's about checking in. It's about making sure that they are okay, making sure, because sometimes our elderly live quite lonely experience times as well. And so we need to make sure that we're touching base with them, that we're making sure that they're okay. Is there anything that they need? And we're making them feel connected.
Making sure they've got toilet paper, poor buggers. Yeah, spare a square.
Yeah.
You don't need that many people. Carly, thank you so much for joining us today. I always appreciate you giving up your time and offering your expertise to us. So thank you.
You're welcome. Anytime.
And now I'd like to welcome Tamika Campbell from Kabul Medical Services. And I just wanted to drop in and see how Kabul is responding to the pandemic we're going through.
Yeah, so we've implemented actions quite early on because we know the risk that this coronavirus can have to our community. So straight away, we started triaging all of our patients and working out how we can keep our well patients or our patients more susceptible to coronavirus safe, and also how we can treat those that may meet that criteria or potentially have coronavirus as well without making, you know, them feel like they're stigmatized or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. So what are some other strategies? Because I've heard a little whisper that you have a video on your Facebook page that is going slightly viral as well, pun included, not included.
So, yeah, you know, we acknowledge that mob Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, sometimes English is not their first language, and we wanted to make sure that we can get the education out there about coronavirus and dispel the myths and look at the health literacy, making sure that we've got nice, easy to understand educational messages whilst we're doing this as well. So we've made a couple of short videos. The first video is why we're actually triaging, just letting people know before they even come in. A lot of our Kabul patients are on Facebook, so they know that when they come here, we're going to ask them those simple questions. And the reason we're doing it is not to cause fear or panic, but it's just to make sure that we're keeping them safe and that we're keeping everyone else that's well in the clinic coming in for their preventative health items or their immunizations or whatnot safe as well. So We've got three videos at the moment, one on our triage process. We've got a video on our telehealth item numbers and a video on hand hygiene.
Yeah, so hand hygiene, as I was saying before to somebody else, it's so important that we understand it's not just you go to the toilet, wash your hands sort of deal. It's almost like a surgical scrub. We want you washing your hands for, you know, the good 20 seconds to break down the viral capsule.
Yeah, absolutely. In our video, we were able to use the blue lights and the education hand cream that you put on first. So we showed all the cream on the hands, did the quick wash, and then we're able to show everyone, you know, how just a quick wash doesn't actually remove everything.
That's fantastic. Wow. So we'll have those up or a link to that on our show notes so everyone can have a look and maybe use them as a resource as well. The other thing, Tamika, talking about the sort of holistic impact of this in our community, we've been talking a lot around the physical effects, but also how are you guys dealing with the emotional sort of stress, worry, fears that might be experienced? And how are you looking after our elders in the community?
Well, at the moment, because we are, we've really taken into account that sort of social distancing and whatnot to keep everyone safe, we don't have as many people coming into the clinic because we're utilising our telehealth item numbers. And because of that, we actually have a little bit of spare time that our health workers and our nurses, our chronic disease nurses have. So we're utilising that time to check in on our elders in the community, to head out and make sure that they're okay. Do you have enough scripts to keep you through? You know, giving them the education and making them feel nice and calm so that they don't have to worry over this period and they don't find themselves heading out to the shops, you know, where they're unlikely to get much anyway, but also, you know, checking in and making sure their welfare is okay as well.
Perfect. So, Tamika, in our communities, we talk a lot about resilience and we've had to overcome a lot of trauma throughout the generations. And this is just seems like another test for us. But how do you see your community getting through this in a way that's a positive thing and not perhaps, you know, the doom and gloom that social media and everyone's thinking about?
Yeah, Danielle, you know, we have had a bit of a discussion about that, and that is actually what we're going to base our next video on, or our next short Facebook video on, is that, you know, what can you do at home if you do find yourself in self-isolation with your family or even just keeping safe over the weekend and really focusing on that reconnection with family and culture and country. You know, like, it's okay to still go out to the parks and, you know, you can still go out and enjoy the fresh air and connect to country and whatnot, and really try and take that time to do things that you don't normally get to do in the hustle and bustle of when everything's all up and running, you've got your footy and all that sort of stuff. So really focusing in on that time as a family to have that connection.
Yeah, and it might be a lovely time for, say, parents to sit and talk to their kids about things that they remember from their childhood, or, you know, reflecting on how things changed before the iPhone, we used to do this. And even going back to those simple way of life, things like doing a puzzle together, or, as you said, I remember when my girls were little, we used to go down and collect bits of nature and sticks and twigs and create artwork out of it.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. So that's something that we're going to put into our next video and just emphasize, like, really use that time, try and use that time well, I guess.
For me, having, as I said previously, having lost my mum, one of the things I regret is I didn't write down or record every word or every story she had so that we can keep those things alive. So even just sharing conversations with family and sort of talking to your kids about funny little things that happened in your past might be a good way to pass time.
Absolutely. Use the time to have a yarn.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Speaking of that, Tamika, thank you so much for dropping in to visit with us today and having a yarn with us. We love your work at Carbel. I'm so impressed that you've rocked out some videos and I can't wait to go and check them out, because it is all about the clear, concise messaging that, you know, is across the board so that patients don't get confused. We can improve their health literacy. So I thank you for that, and I'll be definitely sharing them on my social media.
Wonderful. Always happy to chat with you.
Whilst we are experiencing unprecedented times and the potential risk to Indigenous communities are great, we have opportunities to support each other in ways we have never before. We can reimagine how this will look for us as a society. We can learn about what is important to us, family, community, and culture. We can continue to support our artists and musicians who uplift our spirits. We can safeguard the stories and wisdom of our elders. And we can support our frontline workers in health by washing our hands and practicing social distancing. In the face of fear and the unknown, we can practice kindness and compassion. Thank you so much for joining us today on this very special edition.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe and check out our YouTube channel, Indigenous Health Med Talk. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative, supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.